Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we discover their untold stories. For art's sake and for your sake, I am Alina.
I'm James.
And our special guest today is Steva Zumaya, joining us from Sanya, Los Angeles. She works as an assistant curator at Los Angeles County Museum of Art, also known as LACMA. Steva's love for museums was kindled when she first explored behind the scenes at this very institution. And ever since her graduate school days, she's been focused on shaking up traditional European narratives and shining a light on the untold stories of underrepresented communities. What really stands out about Steva is her collaborative spirit, as it's through teamwork with her colleagues that she brings fresh perspectives to the field. So let's step into Steva's world of art, of untold stories and new ways of seeing things. And of course, let's not forget the magic of teamwork that truly brings her work to life. Welcome, Steva.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alina and James, for having me.
Lovely to have you. Alina's just given you a little intro, as we do for all our speakers. But before we dive into the interview proper, we'd love to hear from you in your own words about what it is that you do. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about yourself and what it is you do at LACMA.
So I'm an art historian that specializes in the 17th century Dutch Republic from my PhD days, but now I'm an assistant curator at LACMA in European Painting and Sculpture. So my department is responsible for antiquity through 1900, essentially. It's a really broad swath of material, and I do a whole range of things, but right now I'm primarily working on exhibitions and a very collaborative process of permanent collection work, reinstalling our permanent collection for the new David Geffen galleries.
So if we could just discuss LACMA a little bit more, because there will be listeners who haven't heard of it and maybe unsure about LACMA and its collection. So maybe you could give us a quick introduction of what LACMA is and even where we might find it.
So the Los Angeles County Museum of Art is one of the biggest museums on the West Coast. It's a kind of encyclopedic museum, meaning we have a really broad, ranging global scope of objects. We have 15 curatorial departments, and we're located in a neighborhood called Mid-City in Los Angeles, kind of on towards the west side. Yeah, that's LACMA.
Are there any highlights from the collection that our visitors should look up or check out?
We have fantastic collections from all kinds of different departments. We have a massive costume and textiles department, prints and drawings, for example, incredible decorative arts and design department. We have Chinese art, Korean art, you name it, all kinds of different stuff. Really impressive contemporary art, and of course, European painting and sculpture, which I shouldn't leave off the list. And it's a small but mighty collection. We have, I think, 400 some paintings, if I'm not mistaken, and a couple hundred works of sculpture, plus coins and medals. And we have big strengths in the 17th and 18th centuries, and including Rembrandt's Raising of Lazarus, if I have to give individual highlights of works of art from my collection. I'm also really partial to Hontorst's Mocking of Christ, because that's a painting from my dissertation days that I really am passionate about.
Since we're talking about your passions, and in fact, I mean, you've worked for LACMA for a while now. It's coming to 5 years. Is this correct?
Yeah, coming to five.
So is there something about museum that drew you to it? If you could maybe talk about this a bit.
Yeah, absolutely there is. I used to actually say in grad school, you know, if there's I had a fantasy of any museum I could work for, it would be LACMA. So I'm very fortunate that I actually ended up getting to work here. Of course, I would have been happy to work in other museums, but I'm very lucky. And what I really love about LACMA is a lot of my family are from Los Angeles, and I've lived in LA a lot, and I know the kind of personalities of the different types of museums and the audiences, and LACMA has always gone out of its way to cultivate kind of a broader range, I think a more inclusive and diverse range of audiences through things like shows about cinema, shows about kind of pop culture, shows that are inclusive of all different types of media. For instance, you know, we had really big successes with shows on Stanley Kubrick, the famous director, or Guillermo del Toro. So I really have always gone to these shows at LACMA, admired them, and thought like, wow, no other museum is doing this kind of thing. Or we've always done really creative installations. And so it's always been something where it's fun and it's, you know, kind of an exciting experience to go to LACMA. It's a little bit less traditional, a little bit less conservative than other museums might be. And I've always found it to be kind of progressive.
Very cool. So that's your sort of journey into LACMA. But let's get a little bit more into you in museums in general. So maybe you can tell us the story of how you first discovered your love for museums or curatorial work specifically. Was there a kind of aha moment where you realized this is what I want to do professionally?
Definitely. As a graduate student, you know, you're kind of, at least as my experience, were kind of forced to walk the path of the academic or the path of the museum worker. At least that was sort of the big main options that were at play for me. And quickly, when I started working in museums, I kind of wanted to try it out and get experience in this field, because of course you need experience to even move forward, right? And once I started working on this show called Sacred Art in the Age of Contact with my colleague, Maggie Bell, who's now at the Norton Simon, and we had this incredible experience for about 4 years working on this show. And I think the aha moment was really just working through that process of collaborating with community groups and collaborating with different types of design teams and workers at the two different museums where the show ended up was really just transformative. And it made me realize that I couldn't do anything else besides this. And even though I still like my PhD work, I found that the kind of collaborative and team, I guess, based nature of curatorial work was really exciting. And I really liked having to, you know, be proud of something at the end with a group of people and having kind of a community come together through the work as well.
We'll definitely get a little bit more into the collaborative and get together aspect just a little bit further down the line, because I'll be honest, I think that will be my highlight. But we'd love to talk about the curatorial work a little bit more. And so as the assistant curator at LACMA, you have a really unique opportunity to curate exhibitions that will, in a way, they will shape the future of the museum. So maybe you can describe your approach to curating exhibitions and what kind of themes or narrative you strive to bring to the forefront.
So my curatorial approach, I would say, is first and foremost global, trying to look at not just Europe, but Europe in relationship to all the other, you know, places in the world with which it had contact. And of course, sometimes contact is more than that, right? It's conflict or it's colonialism. And then my other kind of word I would use is transhistorical. I try to draw connections between the past and the present. That's something I always want to try to do and talk about bigger histories and not just a focused tiny historical moment, which can be important to do as well. But I'm really interested in tracing the effects of what happened in the 17th century, which is the period I specialize in most, and our present day. And I just want to be really critical of the past. And I don't know, a lot of people kind of want to hold the past at this distant reverence, kind of politeness, and say, oh, it's a different time or something. But I really also want to be critical of past actors and how their legacies have lived on in the present.
So in terms of that trans-historical approach that you refer to there, when you're trying to make a historical collection relevant to a modern audience and connecting those historical issues to modern issues, perhaps, or relevant touchstones in your visitors' lives, where do you start with that?
That's a good question. I mean, sometimes the connection's very clear, very obvious to me. Like, for example, with colonialism, which is a 17th century process and structure that is very much still happening. I think, you know, sometimes it might require quite a leap across a couple centuries of you know, changes and developments. But I think it's important to make people realize that something like colonialism isn't a historical phenomenon that you can bracket off neatly with dates, end dates, because there is no end date. What I'm starting from, which is the image, the historical object. So for example, there's a Franz Post painting in our collection that's quite a fantasy of Dutch colonial Brazil, that it's, you know, very much just that. It's a fantasy. It's very romanticized. It shows enslaved Africans sort of resting and dancing, right? And it's meant to be kind of a propaganda image that erases the realities, the horrible realities of that colony. And so starting from that, you know, there's 1,000 directions one could go in talking about the legacies of slavery across the centuries and into the present day, of colonialism in Brazil specifically, the deforestation and destruction that's happened there environmentally. So I've tried to kind of start from that painting and explode outwards in terms of all the different ramifications that just that moment has had, because that painting is functioning for a specific purpose at that historical moment.
And how do you find that your audiences tend to respond to those kinds of connections? Is it shocking for people to see that these same stories being repeated again? Is it something that people deal with well? What tends to be the trend there?
It's a great question. In part, I have to say, I don't totally know yet, because the example that I was just presenting will be kind of presented that way in my forthcoming exhibition. So it's not really I don't have any user feedback yet. So if it's shocking, I guess I'll find out when that happens. But I'd like to think it won't be totally shocking, because at least more and more museums have been talking about these issues in critical ways. I'm thinking, of course, of like the Rijksmuseum just did a huge exhibition on slavery that was really fantastic. And there's been a couple other major presentations like this. So I would hope it's not incredibly shocking at this point.
But yeah, would be interesting to know the responses somehow, if possible at all, you know, maybe down the line. However, would love to go back to something that you mentioned previously, and that's the collaborative nature of the curatorial work. Can you just chat a bit more about your perspective and maybe experience in this aspect of the field?
Yeah, I'd love to. And as I mentioned, that's something that really drew me into this work, was the possibility of working with teams of people. I don't like solo projects or working by myself, but which thankfully I never really have to do. But yeah, in LACMA, it's a really special environment, because a lot of museums are kind of have department, curatorial departments that are siloed, quote unquote, which is a term to describe departments that don't talk to each other or can't, or are maybe like restricted by this actual structures of the museum in some ways. So I'm really free to work with my colleagues across all different departments and beyond curatorial as well, in education, in publications, development, all kinds of different departments as needed. But across the curatorial departments, it's really exceptional. They're all so generous with their collections, and vice versa. They're, you know, curating things for the new building with my objects, and vice versa. And sort of there's very little, I should say, like protectiveness of like, oh, you can't have my object or something. You know, it's very open and very generous. And of course, there's times where maybe someone can't use someone else's thing, but it's all very, you know, democratic and civil when that happens. But I think the openness of collection sharing is really unique. And sometimes I forget that. And I talk to my colleagues in other institutions and I'm like, oh no, it is really special that we're so collaborative, and almost everything we do is collaborative. For the new building, there's almost nothing that I'm doing totally by myself. It's all with a team, even if it's a small one.
Out of interest, was it like this from the very beginning when you joined? When did this start, you know, especially because you were comparing this to other museums and they don't have this at all. So how come you have this at LACMA?
I definitely know that this predates my time, this sort of collaborative attitude and people working together and doing projects across departments and big exhibitions together definitely predates my time. So it's not only 5 years old or so, but it's definitely been around for my entire time at LACMA. And it's, I think, just naturally the case, but also it has had a lot to do with the new building project as well. I think that's helped usher in even more of a kind of a consistency of that practice across the board, because now it's not just special exhibitions we're doing that kind of practice for, we're also doing it for the permanent collection, which was obviously less the case when we all had our own galleries, even though there were still moments of collaboration.
Is there anything you're collaborating on at the moment that you can perhaps give us a little sneaky peek into?
Well, I can definitely talk about my exhibition. I can't give any like specifics as to about galleries for the new building. But yeah. And I think the process of working on my exhibition called The World Made Wondrous, which comes out in September, has been very much representative of what's going on with the new building as well, because I've been working with almost every department across the curatorial departments. And they've been very generous with their expertise and their knowledge and their time. And like, for instance, I just wrote like a small catalog, and they I kind of co-wrote several entries with my colleague in Chinese art, my colleague in decorative arts. And we had this sort of back and forth, you know, where we're Zooming and meeting in person, talking about Chinese porcelain, for example, for extended periods of time, and just having a conversation. So it was really great, because of course I did a lot of research as well, but then it was so nice to go and have like a reading informal chat group with several of my curators, where I could learn from them, to ask questions, and frankly, you know, hey, did Chinese consumers think this and this and this about export porcelain or something, you know, and just have this really nerdy kind of partnership where we could sort out all these fussy details, and then they could give me feedback on my writing.
So in terms of the audiences at LACMA, is there a typical audience? Do you have a typical visitor or a typical crowd who tends to join you?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I can just sort of, I'm sure there's statistics somewhere, but I know it's massively diverse, and just because Los Angeles is, and we serve, I don't have the number off the top of my head. I should have looked that up, but a huge number of people from Los Angeles County. And I know I know that our demographics are driven by local audiences, for sure. We definitely have tourists and out-of-town visitors, of course, but I know there's a really strong presence of local folks that come out from all parts of the city, and we're really excited to welcome even more diversity of folks over the coming years, and we're hoping to kind of build that. And I know that we have a metro line. If you don't know LA, I'll tell you that transportation can be a little tricky here. So we're also very excited about our metro stop, which will be opening up, I think, later this year, hopefully. Hopefully it's not delayed or anything, because that will open up even more folks being able to come out here with greater ease or frequency. But yeah, we have free admission programs and for local visitors, and we try to do all kinds of things to get even more local folks out. And in the summer months, which is, you know, LA, it's like April to November, we have like a jazz night, for example, on Friday nights. It's free and it's open. And on that night, I just like, it's one of my favorite things about LACMA, because it's the most incredibly diverse, all different kinds of people, you know, single people drinking wine, and then families and our staff come out. And so it's this really beautiful, like mixed cross-section of LA, just crowding the park. So people come to our programs as well, even if they don't always come for the exhibitions, or both, hopefully both.
So Diva, you just talked about diverse audiences and local audiences. So how do you engage with these audiences, these visitors? And what kind of impact do you hope your exhibitions will have on them?
Well, it's hard to know. Again, I'm hoping for, a rich visitor feedback element of my forthcoming show, so I can see exactly how they responded or didn't respond to certain things. But I think LACMA has always, for quite a long time now, done a great job at meeting our visitorship interests. Like I said, shows on cinema are a great example. Like my colleague did a show called City of Cinema, Leah Lembeck, and she did that this past June 2022, our summer. And that was a show about Paris, the history of cinema in Paris. And to me, that's like the perfect example of how a European art curator can really talk about something extremely relevant to the neighborhood, right? Anytime we're talking about Hollywood or cinema, that's our local audience right there. So that's just one example. But with my shows in particular, I hope that their kind of global critical stance will be relevant to people. Not that, of course, you know, a show that was just about Rembrandt, for example, wouldn't be interesting to folks. I think it would be, you know, but I do think that there's an advantage to talking about things that are expansive, that are global, and that tell these really expansive stories. Because, for example, if someone comes to my show, they could really just love the Chinese porcelain, you know, and that's okay. Or they could love the crocodiles, and that's also okay. So I like to have hopefully shows where there's something for everyone, or I'm trying to reach as many different types of interests as possible, rather than just one narrow interest like Rembrandt, which again is a totally valid interest.
So you've literally just touched on this idea of including these stories, telling these stories, and bringing people together around those stories. How do you see museums responding to the challenge of having those more difficult topics, or those challenging topics in their exhibitions? And what do you think they could do better in that regard?
I'll just say generally, yeah, I think it's been a huge spectrum of responses to the kind of call, especially in my field, which I can speak to most of all, right, of early modern art history. There's been definitely a call to talk about, you know, colonialism and histories of enslavement, to talk about looted objects, repatriation, things like that, a whole range of topics. And I think there's been some museums and some folks that are just resistant to engaging with it at all, or don't think it's relevant, or think that more political, quote unquote, things should be left for the contemporary oriented folks. But there's also some that are engaging with it really intensely. Like I mentioned, the Rijksmuseum's slavery exhibition, which is obviously a model of how to do this. 2019, there was also a show called Shifting Image in Search of Johann Mauritz at the Mauritz House, which I think was really, really ahead of its time, co-curated by Leah Fendenvinde and Carolina Montero. So that was incredible, kind of reassessing the colonial legacy of Johann Mauritz, the owner of the house that they're in. So there's been lots of different examples I could name of really progressive, thoughtful, critical, and kind of expansive in terms of all the experts and voices that they included as well, different kinds of approaches to these difficult topics. But in terms of what they could do better, I think there are places that are, I think, doing kind of almost a tokenizing approach to these stories, where maybe there's a line in a label, or perhaps there's a nod to things that it's quite superficial. And in some ways, for some institutions, you know, that is progress. So I don't want to be dismissive, because, you know, sometimes it's baby steps forward for some places. But sometimes there are the feeling amongst museum staff that, you know, there's these sort of performative gestures done, but then behind the scenes, you know, the work environment still has a lot of difficulties, or there's, you know, a lot of issues that folks of color are still facing. So then of course, the statements or the gestures on the outside can feel performative. I know that that's definitely shared amongst some museum staff. But for me at LACMA, I felt really privileged to be somewhere that I feel the progressive nature of what we're doing has been pretty consistent.
So yeah, having talked quite a bit about LACMA, would love to ask you about other museums. So obviously, as someone working at one of the West Coast's largest art museums, and given your experience, I'm sure you must be quite well informed of the wider museum and art sector. So maybe can you share with us some examples of museums that you admire, and what practices or maybe initiatives you think are worth highlighting for listeners?
Yeah, I love that question, because I'm always going over like my top five favorite museums, besides LACMA, of course, which I will, you know, toot our own horn all day long. But I cannot get enough opportunities to, again, my colleagues are very bored of hearing about this, but to talk about how great the Amsterdam Museum is. They are an institution, obviously, in Amsterdam that's sort of tasked with telling the history of the city. But they have a fantastic fine art collection, all different kinds of media. But the way they work is so inspiring to me, and it's something I'd love to do more of in the future, because they do everything kind of with communities. So kind of community-based curating is really the main way that they operate, and they work with kind of community advisory groups, but the groups aren't even just advising, they're really driving the curatorial process in a lot of really exciting ways to me. So I always call my colleagues there, and I always try to meet with them and connect with them when I'm in Amsterdam, and I'd love to do more so, more of that in the future. So I will yell about how great they are all day long. And I think the Rijksmuseum is doing fantastic things. I have my colleagues there in the history department, like I already mentioned, the slavery exhibition. I know they're working on fantastic things, and they just did a show on crawly creatures. That's the name of it. They did a show on crawly creatures last year that I thought was really fantastic, and on Clara the rhinoceros. So they're doing great. I'm like, I shouldn't mention an American museum. I have definitely colleagues across the United States that are doing incredible work and beyond. My colleague Adam Levine at the Art Gallery of Ontario, for example, in Ontario or Toronto, is doing incredible, incredible work. He did a permanent collection installation, for example, called European Art on First Nations Land, that was sort of European art being integrative with contemporary Indigenous artwork. And that was fantastic. And he's just did a show called Faith and Fortune about a global approach to the Spanish Empire. So they're doing fantastic things as well. Canada is doing great stuff.
Excellent. We'll have to check them out, and we'll pop some links to those museums in the show notes. So with your extensive experience in the curatorial world so far, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges you've faced in your professional life? And how have you navigated through them to end up where you are?
So I think a natural challenge that a lot of folks face is just the logistics of making it through, like, for instance, a graduate program or, you know, kind of junior curatorial jobs. But I think especially of the graduate program, which for my field, PhDs are very often required for things. So knowing I had to kind of make it through a PhD program, it was often quite difficult financially. It was difficult, you know, in terms of just making it through a couple months with no paycheck, or, you know, figuring out how to make it through kind of difficult financial situations was just personally really difficult, and how to kind of persevere through that. It was hard. I frankly don't know how I did, like, looking back, just through, like, I don't know, gumption, determination. I don't know. That's not really the case. I guess just making ends meet somehow. But it was quite difficult. And I try not to sugarcoat that aspect of it when I'm speaking to young folks in the field, because it is really hard to get through. And I'm lucky to have had a husband who's really supportive. But, you know, if I was on my own, I can't imagine how difficult it would have been. So it's emotionally difficult. It's financially difficult to make it through a PhD program if you're not a wealthy person, which I'm not.
So you've just mentioned talking to young folks in the field. What advice would you give to aspiring curators and art historians who are passionate about making a difference in the field?
I certainly have been lucky to get to talk. I mean, I still feel like I am a young person in the field, of course, in many ways, but I guess to talk to even more junior people or more emerging people has always been a pleasure. And I've been lucky to be able to do that. But the first, at least two things come to mind. And the first thing is really to kind of know your own worth and your own value, because I think sometimes in fields, especially like my field of early modern art history, there can be this scarcity of jobs, of opportunities, of money and fellowships where, you know, I was once of the mindset of like, I just have to take anything because I need the money, right? Which is, of course, also true and completely valid if you're at that place. But I think it's also okay to take a step back and realize that you should be more choosy with where you put yourself and for your own, you know, mental health or your safety, or whatever. I think it's important to do your research about the institutions where you're going to work or the jobs or the grad schools where you're going to go and really know, don't just take anything because you think you have to, right? You know, because you're desperate or something. And that's okay. Again, I don't want to judge people who are at that place. But at the same time, I think it's important to know that you can be more choosy, even when you're very, very junior, to know that you can be more thoughtful about those choices. And the other thing I really wanted to say too was, to not get too pessimistic, I guess. It's easy sometimes in this field, even I catch myself doing it a lot, where you think, you know, it's just so conservative, things are never going to change, it's just so much racism, there's so many problems, museums are horrible, and, you know, you kind of get in this like sort of down in the dumps mindset about it. But I think it's okay to love museums and it's okay to love art and to return to that and to try to be optimistic that there's a better future we can create together. So I'm telling myself that, but I'm also telling everyone else that it's okay to stay optimistic.
And we're going to pivot away from your wonderful advice and pretty sort of serious topics now to a fun, slightly silly question we ask all of our guests. Imagine, if you will, a world in which you have unlimited funding. If you could build or create any type of museum, what would that be?
That is a really good question. I mean, I would love to do something. If I'm going to do like a dorky theme, I would love to focus on like spooky things, maybe like a museum of like Halloween, museum of spooky things with like horror, the history of horror, the history of hell, the history of like demons. And I could buy a really great like Bosch painting that comes on the market. I'm talking about unlimited funding. So I think I could do a lot with that. I also think there's not enough museums focused on cats. I think a cat museum would be very, very profitable. I would see a lot of return on my investment in the cat museum. There is a fantastic cotton cabinet in Amsterdam, which is a cat cabinet that has cat art and actual cats in it, which is fantastic. But that's a kind of smaller venture. I think I could go bigger.
That sounds fantastic.
But I would love to visit both. And it really does sound like fun. So interesting that we never get the even similar answers to this question, right, James? It's just...
Yeah, every single one is radically different from the last one. And that's my favorite bit of the podcast.
I could definitely go more serious and like art historical, but I decided to go the other direction.
Let's keep it as it is. It is a fun question for a reason. So, yeah.
I think if people answer that question seriously, they're doing it wrong. Sorry, Helena, off you go.
Diva, just to wrap up, if there was one thing you could leave our listeners with today, something you hope they'll take away and remember, what would this be?
I would say, I would just want them to know that, you know, museums and curators and art historians and early modern art histories and 17th century art history are thinking about new ways of, you know, rethinking complicated colonial histories, and we're working through these issues. And even though it may take us a couple years to show our work and our products, I hope that they'll come check it out when we do.
Diva, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Diva, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really, really lovely speaking with you. I hope we get to talk to you again soon. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of For Art's Sake. If you liked what you heard, be sure to hit the subscribe button and catch up on our past seasons. You can also connect with us on Instagram at forartsake.uk and Twitter at sake_arts.